that it's true is another thing. So, want to chant the verse again? Let's go chant the verse a few more times. So, purify. Here. Everybody have it out here? Here, don't get lost. There's a copy for you. Oh, you? You look like you were lost. That's just your disguise. Disguised as a bewildered soul. The age of Arimi Damya, which is it? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Janmandyasya Yatunvayat Itaratas Charte Shabhika Swarat.
Janmandyasya Yatunvayat Itaratas Charte Shabhika Swarat.
Tene Brahmaridaya Adikavaye Muhyanti Yatsurayaha. Tejo vari mridam yata vinimayo yatra tri sargum risha.
Tejo vari mridam yata vinimayo yatra
tri sargum risha. Damna svena sara nirasta kuhakam satyam param dimahi.
Damna svena sara nirasta kuhakam satyam param dimahi.
Knows what they mean. Okay? Significant Sanskrit terms or expressions that have come up in the course of this class. This is just a little review. Like the word we just said, dimahi. What is that? Where does it come from? What does it mean? What, buddhi yoga?
It comes from the Gayatri Mantra.
Yeah?
I do meditate.
Right. What about the expression paratattva? Remember that one? You know what that means? Yeah? Yeah, highest principle, highest truth. Uh-huh. What about the word asama urdvam? Yeah?
No one is equal to or greater than.
No one equal or greater. Asama and urdvam. No one equal to or greater. Who's that referred to?
Krishna.
Yeah, that's right. Good. Here's another classical language, summum bonum. We only have Sanskrit and Latin here. nothing lower. Summum bonum, yeah?
Highest good.
Another name for param tattva or what else in Sanskrit? Sanskrit. There's a Sanskrit synonym too. Huh? Param satyam. Did you say that? Okay, I couldn't distinguish tattvam from satyam. Okay. Also para tattva. What about the word adirasa? Adirasa, yeah?
The
that's right, that's the way it is. That's right, just look in your purports. The original and transcendental, is that what he calls it? Transcendental and original sex psychology. Adirasa. What about the expression ekam eva advitiyam? Yeah, one without a second, which is the definition of what? Krishna, absolute truth. What's the difference between these two terms? Vasudeva and Vasudeva. Yeah, who else knows that? Yeah? Which is the patronym? Vasudeva and
son of
Vasudeva. Yes, so the difference between a long A and a short A. Important one sometimes. What does the phrase Janmadyasya come from? Yeah.
Vedanta Sutra.
Yeah, Vedanta Sutra. What does it mean?
Source of creation, sustenance, and destruction.
Yeah, that's right. What's the significance or meaning of the word nitya as opposed to nityanam? Yeah.
One eternal and eternal.
many eternals, right? That's from the Katha Svaitasya Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam. What is the meaning of what is the meaning of the word or the concept Ishvara? Yeah,
controller,
right? Anybody remember what Vibhuti Mat Sattva means? It's in the purport. Vibhuti Mat Sattva. Huh? Who else? You know?
A specifically empowered person.
Yeah, or not just person, but any manifestation that's great or splendorous. Where does it come from? Vibhuti Mat Sattva. Yeah, Bhagavad Gita. Somewhere in there. You could look it up in the exact place. Vibhuti Mat Sattva. Yeah, so those are the kind of things we're going to be looking for you to know, kind of Sanskrit words. Have any questions that you've come up about this material? Yeah?
Can you go over what it means that Krishna is directly and indirectly conscious?
Okay. Prabhupada discusses this in the purport a couple of times. As the super soul of the universe, Krishna is the soul of the universe, he's called. The soul of the universe. The universe is some way like his body. Just like we are in this body as the soul. And we're conscious of everything that goes on in this body. So in the same way, Krishna is directly conscious of the universe, the way that we are directly conscious of our bodies. Except that, Prabhupada said, he knows better. Actually, there are lots of things going on, little processes ticking away, like our heartbeat and things like that. That we're, you know, it just happens. And we're not really very conscious of it. But Krishna's conscious is perfect, so he's directly conscious of everything that goes on. That's the easy part, right? Indirectly conscious means he also gets reports through the bureaucracy. He's got all the demigods. So, for example, what happens in the beginning of Krishna's descent, when there's a burden on the earth, there's a report sent upstairs, right? Mother Earth complains to the demigods. They go up to Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma then reports to Krishna. So that's indirectly conscious, right? So both ways, through the universal hierarchy, the reports go up to him through the devatas. And at the same time, he's directly. Now you may ask, why does he need the indirect? And in fact, I asked Prabhupada this question in Philadelphia. He was on a morning walk. If Prabhupada can directly run the universe, why does he need demigods? Prabhupada said to me, you don't know how to run a universe. Which was true. So anyway, that's what he does. The devatas are there. They need their positions and their posts, and so he gives it to them, even though it's not required by Krishna that he have them. That's what he does. He delegates and has his government, universal government. You might understand that because the absolute truth is a person, therefore, in the principle we studied, they're person throughout all levels of the universe. There's conscious, intelligent direction all the way throughout everywhere. Yeah?
Isn't it also said that Krishna has many gods so that if he's just enjoying, he doesn't worry about
the
initial energy?
Yeah? He delegates a lot of stuff to them, right? They're delegated powers. They're also jivas, they're like us. Conditioned souls with delegated powers. Yeah?
So as a Paramatma also, he knows what's going on in him.
Yeah. As a Paramatma, he's directly conscious of everything. Right.
That's considered directly?
Directly, yeah. It happens, he knows it. Immediately. A little while later, the report comes up. Okay? That's directly and indirectly conscious. Any other questions? Okay. I just wanted to turn to something that hasn't been not really discussed so much in our purport, but is the thing we encounter a great deal in our preaching. And namely, when we say the absolute truth is a person, and we talk about the person the absolute truth is, we have something in mind that's very concrete and very specific, huh? Such as described in the Brahma Samhita, Venum Kwanandam Aravindam Dalaya Daksham. He's playing a flute, wears a peacock feathers on his head. Shaimam Tribhanga, his color is dark blue. He stands in a particular way, so his body is bent in three places. He herds cows, that's his occupation. Boats built with spiritual gems, surrounded by... Everything's very concrete, specific. And this is something of a... People in the West, when they hear about this or see about this, they immediately think, here's something that's symbolic. That these expressions they want to say do not literally apply to the absolute truth, but they must apply in some symbolic way, whereas, which means you use this language, but ultimately you don't believe in it. And the big shock to people when they come to Krishna consciousness is that people believe in it. They have a commitment to this language that most people in Western religious traditions and also in the Mayavadi traditions ultimately get rid of. And so why does this, why is it a shock and why does it happen? Well, of course, you might think that in the West it's a little when we say God is a person, and then people from Christian tradition say, oh, we believe that too. We believe that God is a person. And then when you find out what they mean by person, they're still upset. They don't, the notion that he has, for example, a form, a human form, a body, they're shocked by that. And the notion is that he may be a person, but he's a kind of, well, ghostly sort of person, or abstract sort of person. In the early part of the century, the philosopher and psychologist William James was giving a lecture to a bunch of Unitarian ministers. And just in the course of a lecture, he just wanted a kind of definition of God to reach for. And one, he said that we all believe, he said, without any argument, don't have to argue for it, means, of course, everyone knows this. He said, is that God is, he says, a mental personality. A mental personality. Why just a mental personality? But that's the notion. Well, because you want to get away from bodies, maybe. this is, of course, late Victorian thinking, and people were already a little... People are mortified, actually, by being in material bodies. They've got so many problems attached to them, and you want to, to protect the dignity of God, you have to get them away from something so gross as bodies. And William James is a professor, and all these Unitarian ministers, they were sort of cerebral guys, and they thought, the mental life is higher and more dispassionate and more respectable than being in bodies.
Isn't harmlessness a factor?
Huh?
Harmless. I mean, mental is harmless.
Mental is harmless. Well, I don't know. Sometimes it's pretty vicious fight in there in the mental realms. Anyway, perhaps, they're different ideas. But there's this notion, but the notion is, common notion is that when you think about God, you move in the direction away from what is concrete and particular and sensible, that is to say, apparent to your senses, to things that are more abstract and less apparent to the senses. From gross to subtle.
we just discussed earlier, I think, that hierarchy of gross to subtle, from earth to the more subtle elements like space and then mind. So people actually, speculative thought, when it tends to think of spirit, you know, goes in this direction, and you want to gradually evacuate your concepts of all concreteness and all particularity. For example, look at the speculations of Plato. You start with the world of senses, and you see that there are many particular things. There are many cows, and they come in different shapes and sizes and colors and so on. But we call all of them cows, right? Plato thinks something like this. We call all of them cows. Well, why is that? What is it that obviously they all share in some essence, some essential nature, which is cowness, right? So Plato postulated that if you have all these particular concrete cows with proper names and a numerical variety of them, all these different cows here, they all participated in something called, you know, cowness, which really existed outside the realm, in a kind of ideal realm, which was, the Greek word is eidon, which is translated as idea or form. But it's not a form like we mean with a shape. It's just cowness, the abstract essence of cows. You know, you can't milk it. you can't hurt it. But it's there, this eidon, right? And so, according to Plato, there was a whole world of ideal types, right? Because there was cows, there was human beings, there was this, that was other, right? So you had this whole thing where you lack individual in particular. What are these ideas? They're mental entities, aren't they? I mean, a cowness is something that's perceived in the mind, not merely with the senses. When you think about, when you use the word cow, you're not thinking about any particular cow, are you? You're thinking about just any cow. Or cowness. So already, you see, we're on the mental platform, so to speak. You know, there's this mental level of mental things. So now you've got the realm of ideas. Then one notices there's still a plurality. And what do all these ideas have in common? Well, they're all ideas. So they also participate and derive their existence from a higher level, the ultimate being called the form of forms, or the idea of ideas. This is the Param Satyam. So you're just, by a gradual process of abstraction, because these, he says, are more real than these. Because these come and go. Just a minute. These come and go. Individual cows are born and die, but cowness is eternal. Okay. And then to solve the problem of where do these come from, and what are the essence that these have in common, there's this. So this is actually the source. So as you go from gross to subtle, you go from what is less real to what is more real. But gradually, you see, also you're becoming more abstract. This is an abstraction of abstractions. In the form of the good. That's Plato's kind of speculative way of getting at the absolute truth. This does correspond to something in Vedic thought. You know what it is?
Living entities and supreme.
No. These aren't individual living entities. These are ideas. They're abstractions.
Ontology of, like, earth, air, fire.
No. Those are deaths down here. What it is, actually, is the Vedas. The Vedas have the blueprints, or the archetypical forms of all the
types of living entities in the material world. This is the realm of the Vedas, is the closest correspondence I can see. People sometimes think of Plato's idea world as analogous to, say, Goloka Vrindavan. But it's not, because there are individual cows there. There's not a, you know, ideal type of a cow. There's lots of cows, each of them with proper names. You've gone beyond this. This is the impersonal Brahman. By his process of abstraction, also involving renunciation as a spiritual practice, somehow or other, Plato was able to get some kind of realization of the level of impersonal Brahman by going up this way. Did you, Ian?
Yeah, did Plato consider those, how do you pronounce it, Aidan?
Aidan, yeah.
Aidan as simply mental constructs, or did he give them...
No, they were out there real. Yeah, they were out there real. It was Aristotle who said, you know, come on, there's... Then there became a big debate in philosophy. Realism, which says these things exist, and nominalism, which says they're made up human constructions. That goes on for, you know, a couple of 1,000 years or so. It's still going on. But anyway, he thought, no, they're real. And they possess... Neoplatonism, these possess, you know, potency, and they create their instantiations within the material world. It all flows out and flows back again, you know. Just goes out and sucks back up. Like that. I don't want to get into this too much, because this is like a whole technical subject. But I just want to give you this notice. This is what we are accustomed to in the West. That another way where we also... it's just this very notion of the incompetence of our language. You see, also language starts to fail you, you know, as you go up this ladder. Or just in general, people say, like this, theologians, they reason like this. Our language is made and comes about through our traffic with sense objects in the material world. It's embedded in the material world. When we start to use our language to describe transcendence, or what is beyond our experience, obviously our language fails. It can't quite work. And really, when we start to describe the absolute truth, where all things come to be the ultimate unity of everything, then language has to stop. Our language is used in the relative world. Now we're talking about the absolute world. So the best thing that you can say is silence. And that's the most accurate, you know. This is all, everywhere, this is like street Buddhism, you know. They all like to go back to some big revelation of Buddha where he just smiled and held up a flower, you know, and that was the ultimate speech. Ikshite na ashabdam.
Yeah.
That counteracts that in Vedanta Sutra. Ikshite na, the absolute truth is not inexpressible by words. Na ashabdam. Ikshite na ashabdam is not not indescribable by words. Vedanta Sutra says opposite, but...
Sanskrit is a transcendental language, so it's said that Sanskrit could be used to describe
it. Yeah, well, see, our philosophy of language is a little different. They want to say, you know, that our language is rooted in this world, and we stretch it to reach the absolute. It breaks, you know, like a rubber band that's gone too far, and all you can do is say, silence, you know. Thomas Aquinas says, for example, he says this in Summa Theologica, he says, the more abstract the terms are, the more properly they pertain to God. That's there in black and white. That's what he says. The more abstract the terms are, the more properly they pertain to God. Abstract means less worldly, less, you know. So you have this is the specular traditions ends up in this way, in silence or something that's very close to it. But you can't say even that God is good, for example.
Why can you say good means in contrast to evil, but God is obviously in the absolute realm. There's no contrast between good and evil, so he's beyond that duality, so you can't really say good either. You might as well say evil if you're going to say good for all that. And so really, the wise know God cannot be spoken about. And so there's these naively faithful people. They go to church and everything. They worship God and they sing hymns. But that's for people on a lower level. Those of us who are on the higher level, you know, we know that you cannot say anything. This is the kind of standard way of things. So then you come along with this, you know, Chintamani Prakara Sadmasu, blue cowherd boy, and so on. That he has a form. That he's a person. All this stuff strikes people as very strange.
Well, first of all, we can see that the process of negation is incomplete. Here you're going to describe what is the greatest of all, and you end up with a big zero. Because if you describe the absolute truth simply by negation, no name, no form, no quality, no relationships, how does that differ from nothing at all? You may say God, but really, you've got nothing. And mystic theology will talk like that. The divine non-being, they will say. You know, as though you've got something spectacular. But it's nothing. It's a big zero. It's inadequate. And negation, if you're trying to... Prabhupada has an argument against negation. He says, you're trying to define the absolute by negations. But these negations are the opposites of that which they are negating. So they're also relative. You're trying to get a conception of something that is absolute or not related to anything else, right? So I say, here's all these material forms. So that's relative. So the transcendence must be no form. The absolute must have no form. But the idea of form depends upon... The idea of no form depends upon the idea of form. So still you've got an opposite. You're still in the material world. You've still got an opposite of something else. So your form and formless. Your formlessness is also a material conception of the Supreme. So in this way you can see that it's incomplete. So the actual situation, if you want to know the truth, is, you see, these speculative attempts to define, by speculation, to define the absolute, they come to some kind of a, you know, you start with the plurality and the diversity of this material world, and by speculation you come up to this point where your thoughts cannot proceed anymore, a singularity, you know. Where everything comes to a stop, there's some ineffable unity from which everything proceeds. This is a common experience of the mystics. Now, what they do not know, because of the limitations of their method of going up, is that the whole thing keeps going. And this is just a boundary line. And they get up to this boundary line, and this is what they report. What we have from the Vedas is all this. This figure is described, I've done a little abstractly, but it's described basically as a tree. In the Bhagavad Gita. There's a tree with its roots upwards and its branches downward. And that's the reflection of the real tree. So this is where this comes from. So we go further. You come from this. Here is the impersonal Brahman, which is like a singularity here. And as you go, where all your everything goes, all your instruments go haywire. Where your language stops functioning. But if you can go beyond, then there's this other realm of this notion here, transcendental variegatedness. Not the variegatedness of the material world, but this transcendental variegatedness. Venum quanantam aravindam dalaya daksham barhavatam smasitam buddhasundarangam kandarpakotika. That's described there. That's our proposal. And because you cannot give what you have not got, the fact that this has shape and form and properties and individuality here also indicates that all these things are here, but in some super excellent fashion, which is not really comprehensible by the contaminated minds in this place. It is a fact. Atasi Krishna Namadi Namaved Grayam Indriyai. It is a fact that our materially contaminated senses cannot grasp the name, form, qualities, etc. of Krishna. In that sense, all the where it always says that you know, words fail, language stops, that to in some respects it is very true. Your mundane language, it won't reach up. It won't go. So, as David said, that's the language we use is, in fact, not mundane. That's what we have to say. When we are given, in say, the Brahma Samhita, which describes Krishna, and so on, or even just take something... to another. They all fold just out of those syllables because it's those Krishna and Krishna's name are the same. Abhinatvat nama naminaho. So that mantra is not a product. It doesn't come from down here. It's not formed by our commerce with the material world. Where does our language come from? Janmadasyataha. It comes from the absolute truth. And that the original function of our language is to glorify Krishna. So the philosophers have this notion of describing God as something like, they call it analogical predication. Huh? Nice, huh? Analogical predication. That says, well, here our language is, you know, used here in the material world, and we apply it to God. To say he's something like that. Something like good, something like great, something like all these things that we have. So that really it's not to be taken literally. It's not to be taken literally. When it says God is my father or anything like that, not really literally to be taken, but something of that relationship is there. You ever sit and talk to some like a Christian priest or something, you know, and push him on this, what does it really mean? He'll say, you know, he has no idea, because he starts to think about the meaning of all these terms, and that's why they start to play around with it all the time, that they think they can change it around, because it's really all a concoction, you know. That there's no real authority for any of it because it's all made up by us. So, but here, what we see is they want to say you start here and you go up. Actually, here's the original meaning of the terms. And by analogy, somehow or other, they're used down here. The real meaning of, say, dark blue, Shyama, that refers to Krishna. And by some kind of analogy, it's used to refer to things of this material world. So the literal meaning of the words about Krishna apply here. That's the literal meaning. So if someone wants to say, do you believe that Krishna's literally a blue cowherd boy? We can say yes. But until we have purified vision, we can't say exactly what that means. Because when we see Krishna, it'll be nothing like you imagine. You'll see, oh yes, he is. He's a blue cowherd boy, but like you've never seen a blue cowherd boy like that.
But it doesn't mean that we give up this language. That's the Mayavadi speculation is you give up the language on the basis that really it's all a concoction and the truth is somewhere here. And that's as far as they get. What we have is given from here. Naturally, there's some resemblance, but this is the original thing. Yeah.
One thing I like to use from the Bible, and I'm wondering how the...
Why are you wearing one glove?
Because I like to write with this hand.
You're cool? Okay.
There's a description of in Revelation of the Lord's form, which is actually very beautiful, and sitting on a throne, and with Jesus sitting on his right hand. Mm-hmm.
They say it's symbolic. Oh, they say it's symbolic.
Most of the people buy it as it is.
They'll do that because most people will. But you have to talk to somebody, you know, who's got an education. They'll tell you it's symbolic. Only what they used to call in my religion department is naive believers. In other words, people who don't have educations, they tend to be working class, so on. They take it literally. They take it literally. They expect to see a big throne up there, 80 feet high. They all, you know, it says in the Bible that God walked in the garden of the cool of the evening. Go to any rabbi and say, here it says, he has a form, he walked in the cool of the evening, and they'll show you all the commentaries that says it's symbolic. All kinds of places. It says that when Moses was on Mount Sinai, he couldn't see the face of God, he could only see his backside. That, you know, God had a face and a backside. they don't accept it. Yes, good. You're, yeah. That's right. That's right. Sometimes it's better off. You're better off.
Huh? And this tree picture with the reflection of the tree, the things on the leaves of the tree facing down, of the leaves of the upside down tree are the highest things in the spiritual truth.
Yeah.
So the individual instances of things are the most exalted things.
Yeah, in the spiritual world. Right. Here, I mean, I don't know how close you want to put this, but all Prabhupada says about here that sometimes what is highest in the spiritual world appears as what is lowest in the material world. He had an example. The highest thing in the spiritual world is the parakīya rasa of the gopīs, which is in the a conjugal love in the mood of an adulterous relationship. Of course, there's no real adulterous relationship. They all belong to Krishna. But still, that mood is there. But that becomes reflected in what is something very low in the material world. Yeah.
Well, we call the highest things basic. We call the highest things basic.
Yeah, right. That's okay. Now, one thing we should understand is this idea of a person. Let me just give you a few. That's been very nicely described by Prabhupada, what it means by person. He says, to say that the Absolute is a person is to say that the Absolute has senses. It's a very interesting... A person, in other words, we have senses. Senses are instruments. As you know, in the Vedic analysis of senses, there's two kinds of senses. Senses for perceiving the world, sound, touch, taste, smell, hearing, the sense of hearing and taste and touch, seeing. And also the hands, the legs, senses for acting back on the world, these instruments for acting back on the world. They're called the karmindriya, or active senses, or active instruments. Instruments for manipulation, instruments for locomotion, instruments for sound production, instruments for reproduction, instruments for evacuation. These are called the five karmindriya. So if you take all the instruments by which we act back on the world,
And the Gyanindriya, the knowledge-acquiring senses by which the world acts upon us, we can see that what a body is, what we mean by body, is an organized array of instruments.
Or sense organs. So it follows that if the absolute truth is a person, person means has senses, then it follows has form or a body. That's what we mean by person.
Interesting notion. This instrument, it means that therefore there has to be, if there's senses, then there's sense objects. That means there's an environment. And that's one reason why it is denied that God is a person. Because it makes him one among many. You know, there's an environment. Here's Krishna, and here's Krishna's environment. Limited. But God is unlimited. How can he have an environment? See here, here's my, you know, the environment begins here, and this is my form means limitation. God is no limitation, therefore he has no form. That's the common notion. But of course, if he has no form, that's also a limitation, not to have form. There was a film a while ago while George Burns showed up smoking a cigar and playing God. I heard about it, I didn't see it. And somebody was astonished to see him, you know, as a human being. He says, "You think I'm just a cloud of gas?" He says. Well, he's not George Burns either. He's definitely not a cloud of gas. So, not to have a form is also a limitation. So Krishna has form. But at the same time, he has this environment. But what is this environment? It is his own energy. It is his own potency that creates that environment. So in one sense, he's everything. All that there is Krishna and Krishna's energy that exhausts the ontology. Right? So he is one without a second, that besides which there is no other. If you take it all, him all together as Krishna and Krishna's energies, which is the whole picture. So still he's not limited, even though he has his environment and other living entities with whom he interacts. If he doesn't have those things, if he can't play, what a limitation that is. If he can't have relationships, I mean, all these things that are wonderful things, glorious things, all of a sudden he wants to be deprived of them. Mostly because in the material world, we've tried to do these things independently of Krishna, like have relationships and become such sourpusses about the whole enterprise that we think, you know, God would never get involved in this kind of stuff. But he has them in an exemplary fashion. His relationships are not undercut with all the problems that we have. Because when we try to form relationships without Krishna's being involved, then they all are... give us problems.
And therefore when people want transcendence, they don't want relationships. In fact, they're going into spiritual life just to get away from people. They want the ultimate isolation. That's what they're looking for. So they become afraid, Prabhupada says, of the idea of individual personal existence. They hate themselves. They hate themselves and they hate everybody else because of their horrible experiences in the material world. So you tell them God is a person, that's the last thing they want to hear. That's the part of the pathology that leads to these impersonal ideas. Any other questions? Yeah?
Last night in the lecture devotion course, we heard about the reference to the verse that we're doing in regard to how everything is in this verse, including all the way up to the conjugal rocks.
Everything is in this verse?
Yeah, that is all the way up in terms of the rocks and everything. It's in the one more blood.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there. So I wonder if
Prabhupada explains that in the purport. unfold the interior meaning of the verse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Prabhupada does it, right?
He mentions this. It's not, you know, it's not, what do you have to say? It's not explicit, it's implicit. And what he says is this word, dhimahi, param satyam dhimahi, that's like being initiated. And then when you become initiated, then you can understand these things. So there won't be any explicit reference, but that dhamna, all transcendental paraphernalia, then satyam param dhimahi, that all the rasas are in there. That's why Prabhupada puts the comments in here about adiras is in here because of this dhamna swena sada narasta puhakam satyam param dhimahi. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
How are we to understand the power of this verse? What's the Lord say? I made a vow to chant it for the next few years every day. Should you get a conversation like that?
Yeah. Because
everything's there.
Yeah, there's certain words that pack a lot. You know, like the Hare Krishna mantra. Or for example, what we call mula mantras. Om, Kleem, Shrim, Ram, Shraum. All kinds of things evolve out of these words.
So the last line of the verse, it has Kuhakam Satyam Param.
Dhimahi.
Is that kind of Om embedded in the end of each
verse? No, Om is, it starts with Om. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudeva. It starts with Om and ends with Dhimahi. And what happens is, with that, as he says with the Dhimahi, it indicates the process of initiation into the Gayatri Mantra. So that whole process. If you really, you know, if you want to study this verse and understand it, you also have to go through the processes of purification, which open up more and more of its meanings. Prabhupada said, you know, that everything about Krishna, it's just like we study about Krishna, that each limb of his body contains all the potencies of the whole person. Every sense can perform the function. This is this holistic feature of the absolute truth, like a hologram. You know, the whole thing is in every part. So that's true about Srimad Bhagavatam too. That's true about Srimad Bhagavatam. So you can take, Prabhupada says about Srimad Bhagavatam, if a person reads one line, one word, his life will be changed. Because actually it's in there, even if you don't realize it. But then when you become to realize it more and more, then Krishna directly appears, he says, in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. If Srimad Bhagavatam is heard with proper attention. But it cannot be heard with proper attention unless one is pure in mind. And one cannot be pure in mind unless one is pure in all the activities of life, even the basic eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. When one's life is entirely pure, then the mind becomes pure, then it can concentrate properly on Srimad Bhagavatam, and then Krishna is fully manifest directly in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah?
Can it really be as easy as it says in the purport that if you give away Srimad Bhagavatam on a full moon, you go back to Godhead?
Try it. Yeah, you definitely should. If you give it away anytime, actually.
How fast is another question. But that you'll go back, that's fixed up. Okay, so tomorrow, I don't know what time we're going to meet to have the test. I'm sorry about the confusion. But sometime we'll meet and we'll... You got a little extra time to study. Okay, then we'll have some Easter ghosties tomorrow too. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.